So let me tell you a little bit about my guest today, because we're going to be talking about thought crime and freedom of speech, opinions, and for your brain to go wherever it feels like going, unless, of course, you're someone like Ernst Zundel. His name is Mark Weber. He is director of the Institute for Historical Review. It's a leading dissident history research and publishing center, and I'll tell you what, he's done the homework. So what we're going to learn together today is, was what we were told about anything to do with World War II ever true in the first place? And why is it that people that express different opinions based on heavy documentation that they do on their own end up in prison? So let me introduce Mark Weber. Good morning, Mark.
Yes, good morning, Maria. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Well, I'll tell you, I've done quite a bit of reading on your website and on Zundel's site, and a lot of it was new to, and I won't say a lot of it was new to me, but I have to tell you, it's pretty interesting stuff in a time where here in America, we also are under gag order and have to be careful what we say.
Right.
What got you started on your work with the Institute for Historical Review?
Oh, gosh. It really started years ago. I was raised in America, like everyone else, with a very, I would say, cartoonish view of history, and not only about World War II, but about the Middle East. My views about the Israel-Palestine issue were strongly influenced by, for example, the movie Exodus, which came out in the 50s.
Right.
And my view about World War II and about the Holocaust, although that word wasn't widely used before the 1970s and 80s, was influenced a lot as well by motion pictures and such. But the older I got, the more I realized that the situation about World War II and about the Middle East and about much of what we hear in history is more complicated than that, and not as simplistic as we've been told.
Right. Well, you know, it depends on who you talk to how they're going to use the expression, history is written by the victors. You know, to a lot of black people, history is written by the white people. So in looking back, you know, and reading through your site and so much information, I was like, wow, have we totally been duped about everything? Because knowing that our government lies to us about everything here, especially, you know, let's look at, you know, September 11th, it makes perfect sense that there's a lot of lying going on about who was or wasn't the hero of a war or a Holocaust that, you know, U.S. industry pretty much financed.
Well, that's right, because how we view history even changes. Even during our lifetime, how we view American history has changed.
Absolutely.
The Civil War, Reconstruction, the 1940s, 50s, much of that has been changed. But there's a tendency of people to accept that whatever the official view is right now has always been the official view or the accepted view, and that's just not true. And it's also true about World War II. If you look at American history books or history books in high schools and colleges about world history, what happened to the Jews of Europe during World War II is portrayed very differently than it is in the history books and the textbooks that we now see in our schools. In fact, the word Holocaust didn't come into wide usage until the late 1970s, especially prompted by a big NBC television miniseries that went on for a week that really propelled that into the public consciousness. And out of that came the, at that time, the president's commission on the Holocaust, which is now the United States Holocaust Memorial Council, an official U.S. government agency, is in charge of a tremendous museum in Washington, D.C. So that even in our own lifetime, the series of events, which are now called the Holocaust, given this sort of one name, has taken on this official status in our society, and more than that, as any number of writers have pointed out, an even kind of religious status in our society.
Right. Well, I say it as an elitist status, to
well,
tell
elitist
you the truth.
And obligatory, so that now emphasis on the wartime suffering of Europe's Jews is an obligatory part of the school curriculum in many schools across the country, and, of course, in many countries around the world, in a way that it was not in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and up until the 70s and 80s.
Right, exactly. And, you know, I watched that short film you sent me last night, and I'd like to give out your website. The initials it's the Institute for Historical Review, IHR.org. And I have to tell you, one thing I really like about it, Mark, is you put it in common sense reality. When I was listening to maybe, you know, the first 5 minutes of your video, and you mentioned, you know, that there's museums for the Holocaust. There are annual observances for the Holocaust. There's tons of movies made about it. It's almost as though, you know, like the films we kept seeing on 9/11, like a psyop to keep us all in slumber and not question anything. Mm-hmm. And that really isn't done for anyone else. No one's making, you know, at least I've had a few small producers on the show, but in reality, no one's been making these kind of films or honoraries to the Palestinians that are being slaughtered by the Israelis, to the Lebanese that just had their country blown up by the Israelis, of which we're paying for that war, or, you know, the people dying in Darfur. You know, you look at that and you make it pretty much common sense. Why is it that what happened, something that happened, supposedly happened 60 years ago, is still so much in the forefront?
Right. That's very true. Well, of course, on the Middle East situation, there's already been a tremendous increase in public awareness of that over the last few years, but as former President Jimmy Carter has pointed out in his new book and in a number of interviews he's given, mm-hmm. there is still nothing like a real open debate or discussion about the Middle East situation in this country, much less so than even in Israel itself, or certainly in the rest of the world. And that's a situation that has very real time, real impact in our present day. It's not something that, you know, is we're talking about 60 years ago, 70 years ago. Events even happening now, or the background to events happening now, are still very much distorted in the American media. Now, the situation is really much better than it was a few years ago, mm-hmm. and anyone who's over 30 or 40 will remember just how very little we heard about any of this when we were young.
Oh, absolutely. I could tell you. Zip. That's what we heard. Nothing. Let me ask you this, Mark, because I know you've been, you know, on this particular topic a lot deeper and longer than I have. What is it? I mean, what do you think? What is it that creates such fear, hatred, and anger amongst people when you start talking about the Holocaust?
Well, there's a lot of reasons. One of them is that, as I point out in the video that you were talking about, for many Jews, the Holocaust is such an emotionally important part of the worldview. It's become a central feature point in the mindset of many Jews and of the State of Israel, so that looking at it with any kind of detachment or objectivity is like looking at the life of Muhammad with objectivity. It might be looked at with many Muslims might be offended if you were to talk about Muhammad in that way, or Buddha for a Buddhist or something, or of course for Christians, talking about the life of Jesus without a kind of proper reverence or something. And
right.
The Holocaust has that kind of role for Israel and for many Jews, so that even looking at it, talking about it, saying, well, this isn't quite the way it was, or this isn't accurate, or let's look at this, is just infuriating to many people. Well, that's unfortunate, because for most of the world, the Holocaust is not a unique event. It's an event that should be looked at with the same scrutiny and the same understanding and the same empathy as any other
absolutely
terrible or horrific event in history. The point I make over and over isn't that Jewish lives and suffering should be ignored, but that it should not be given greater reverence and attention than the suffering and the deaths of other people.
Right.
That I think is we can all agree upon, because the victims of all genocide, war, and oppression deserve to be remembered.
Right, but you know, it seems as though history and the way we've been raised, especially here in America, it seems as though we only think that the Jews were killed during World War II.
Well, I've made the point a number of times that in America, we're expected reflexively to know, quote-unquote, that 6 million Jews were killed during World War II, were killed by Hitler.
Right.
But the average American, even educated Americans, have no idea how many Poles, Germans, Russians, Americans, British, Chinese, lost their lives in World War II. We're told over and over and over about the suffering and the deaths of Jews in World War II, virtually to the exclusion of many others. And just as a point of that is that very few people know that the number of Chinese who lost their lives in World War II alone vastly outnumbers the number of the Jewish deaths during that conflict.
Right, Chinese and Russian and so many other people.
That's right.
We hear
almost nothing about that.
It's an incredible thing. I mean, I have covered that on earlier shows. And for my listeners, please go in and listen to the earlier shows I've done with Dave McGowan, because we give you those figures of just how many lives every country lost in World War II.
Right.
Now,
and
one of my listeners has an interesting point, and I'm sure you're going to roll with it, Mark. And his name happens to be Mark, too.
Okay.
He says, hold on a sec, because he's sending me so much stuff. He says that the whole thing about the Holocaust is that it's a linchpin to Israel's reason to exist.
Well, I was going to stress the relationship between the view we have of the Middle East and Middle East history and the obligatory, you might say, semi-official, quasi-religious view we have of the Holocaust in our society. They are very closely related, and you'll find on our website essays by me and by others quoting any number of even Jewish writers who stress the centrality of the Holocaust story for Israel and for many Jews. And yes, there's a very, very close relationship, and it's very obvious that the Holocaust plays the role as it does in our society for very clear motives to promote Jewish Zionist Israeli agenda.
Right. Well, I can tell you, I've been accused of being a Zionist bitch, so I guess after today's show, that title might go away. let me ask you this, you know, and again, it's for me, I look at what you put out, and I get the punch points, the points that I think other people will wake up really quick with, and one of them that woke me up was where you say, yes, you know, the Jews were interned in concentration camps during World War II, however, the Japanese Americans here were also interned in concentration camps at the same time during World War II, and yet there's no great mythology or heroism that came out of that for them.
Well, I don't want to overstress the point. Yes, that's quite true. Although the number of Japanese who were rounded up was much smaller, and the conditions, of course, were nowhere near as brutal or as harsh as the event that was given out to Jews in Europe during World War II.
Right.
A lot of reasons for that. I've often said, though, that if Japanese troops had actually landed in the United States, or if American cities had been bombed in World War II by Japanese bombers, I think that the treatment of Japanese Americans in this country would have been a lot more brutal, a lot harsher than it actually was. But yes, I mean, the internment of people and the brutalization of people is not, of course, confined to Jews. I've made the comparison, and others have made the comparison, between the immense deportations, ethnic cleansing, roundups, and killings of people by the Soviet Union, by the Soviet regime, especially under Stalin, and by the communist regime in China. And, of course, we just hear almost nothing about that in our popular culture in the way that we hear about the suffering of Jews in World War II.
Right, exactly. And, again, I want to implore my listeners, go to his website, start reading. There's way too much there that we can possibly cover in one show, but we are going to do the best we can. Another thing that hit me like a ton of bricks, I even told my girlfriend about it at dinner last night, Mark, was, you know, I'm so busy constantly pointing out the propaganda that goes on in the world today when I deliver the news, that for some reason, I guess maybe my mind split, and I didn't think about how much propaganda we've been told since World War II, and until I read that The Diary of Anne Frank, probably one of my favorite books and favorite movies, was also propaganda, not written by a young girl hiding out in Germany, but written by, you know, an author who had to take Anne Frank's father to court to get paid for his book.
Well, no. Anne Frank did do a lot of writing. The diary that everyone can buy in a bookstore was mostly written by Anne Frank, but it's put together from a number of things that she wrote. It's not true. It's about the payment. That was a payment actually over a man named Levin, who was suing the family or the father for of a play script of a play, not of the book itself.
Oh, okay.
The book itself has been greatly edited. Things have been taken out. It's been reorganized and so forth. But as I say on any number of occasions, the story of Anne Frank is more interesting to me, not for what's in the diary, but for the story of Anne Frank herself, which is really very typical of the fate of many Jews in Europe during World War II. Mm-hmm. And this is this. Anne Frank was not gassed. She wasn't killed. She died of typhus in the Bergen-Belsen camp in March of 1945, about 6-7 weeks before the end of the war. But Anne Frank was deported to Auschwitz in late 1944. As the Soviet army was approaching the camp, she and her sister were evacuated from Auschwitz hundreds of miles to the west, to the Bergen-Belsen camp, where, of course, tragically or sadly, she died of typhus. But she was not killed. I mean, the story is more complicated than that.
Mm-hmm.
Father not only survived Auschwitz, he survived Auschwitz and was in Auschwitz in the camp infirmary when the Red Army liberated or took the camp in January of 1945. I mean, the point is that the fate of Anne Frank, as tragic as it is not the fate of someone who was singled out for extermination, but rather the fate of someone who died as an indirect result, both of German policy and of the consequences of the war.
Uh-huh. Now, I'm sure you're aware of the Holocaust conference that happened in Iran this past month.
Of course. Well, that has focused the world's attention to a great degree on this phenomenon that's called, in our media, Holocaust denial. Now, in fact, it's a stupid phrase. It's a very polemical phrase because I don't know anyone who, quote, denies the Holocaust. In fact,
right.
The term is loaded. The term implies that those who, quote, deny the Holocaust do so deliberately. That is, they know they're lying and they just decide to lie for whatever reason. But it's of course, a very loaded and polemical term. The Holocaust conference was presented during the time it was taking place in our media in a very misleading way. Almost none of the speakers actually even talked about the Holocaust as a historical event. They talked about, how the Holocaust story plays the role it does in our society. And also, contrary to what the impression you might have gotten from the media, there were a number of Jewish speakers and participants in the conference itself,
mm-hmm.
including a number of anti-Zionist Orthodox Jewish rabbis who, for their own reasons, are very hostile and opposed to the State of Israel and its policies. But the conference has given new public attention around the world to those people who are skeptics of the official Holocaust story.
Mm-hmm.
And to that extent, it's good. It's also important because the conference emphasized and highlighted the fact that the Holocaust is given a special status in European law that no other chapter of history is, so that those who are skeptical of it, express any dissident view of it, are imprisoned, fined, or forced into exile in a number of European countries.
Right.
This is a very blatant double standard that especially many in the Muslim world are conscious of, because writings or publications which Jews regard as offensive are banned in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And are punished and are destroyed, they're
right.
censored, whereas publications which are offensive to Muslims or to Christians or to others are protected under the motto of free speech. And this is a double standard that is very, very riling, very, very upsetting, enraging to many people around the world, but especially in Muslim countries.
Right. Well, you know, here in America, you have people like Hillary Clinton, who just a few years ago, all of a sudden discovered her grandmother was Jewish.
Yeah.
You know, I find that incredible. You know, I think I knew what my grandmother was as soon as I opened my eyes. Pushing for these anti-Semite laws here in America, of course, you know, denying that the Palestinians are true Semites, but that's, you know, a story for a whole nother show.
Right.
And you look at it and you say, well, why is it that they're getting this special treatment even here in America, where, you know, it's okay to, you know, slam the blacks in America, or, you know, any other group, you know, call an Italian a WOP or whatever and get away with it?
This is a point that Marlon Brando made in an interview several years ago on the Larry King show.
Uh-huh.
He said that Hollywood has portrayed in a very derogatory, offensive way virtually every group except Jews, he says. And he was very upset about this, and was pretty emphatic about this, and this is somebody who knows something about Hollywood. But yeah, there's a in our cultural life in America, there's a very, very, very strongly philo-Semitic or very pro-Jewish, pro-Israel outlook in our mass media. And that's why public opinion in this country and the political views in this country are very out of step with those of virtually the rest of the world. The only two countries, that have this tremendous emphasis on Israel and Jewish suffering are the United States and Israel. And we're sort of out of step with the whole rest of the world.
Just look at how we vote together at the UN. We're totally against the rest of the world.
Time and time again.
Right.
Are these lopsided votes in the United Nations, in which the United States and Israel are on one side, and the whole rest of the world, virtually, is on the other.
Uh-huh.
Because there's we Americans are expected to have a special sensitivity to Jewish suffering and Jewish concerns, Israel's concerns, in a way that we are not supposed to have about the sufferings and the concerns of other people.
Right, right. Now, the part that really shocks and annoys me, just, I don't even know it's as an American, just as a thinking person. You know, I saw the movie years ago, A Minority Report, where people in America are getting arrested for thought crime. And, of course, the story of Ernst Zundel, you know, Mr. Irving, Rudolph, these people that have been thrown into prison because in certain countries, which I think America is going to be right behind, it's a crime to publicly dispute the official version of Holocaust history. These are not people that have been out there as axe murderers, rapists, or, oops, starting illegal wars. These are people that spoke out or printed something about the Holocaust that wasn't in step with the propaganda that we've gotten all this time.
Right.
And that, to me, is the scariest thing, is when a human being can't express themselves or have a different opinion and end up going to jail for it.
Right. Well, the highest profile victim of these Holocaust denial censorship laws has been David Irving. Now, he was just a few weeks ago released from an Austrian prison where he had been held since November of the previous year, that he was held for 13 months for remarks he had made, and get this, 16 years earlier.
Oh, Mark, God.
16, I mean, I've made the point, if he had stolen a car 16 years ago, nothing would have happened.
Right, the law would have been over.
It would have been a statute of limitations for
right.
it. But because of remarks made 16 years earlier, in which he referred to, I think, mythical gas chambers at Auschwitz. I'm not. I'm a little unclear about exactly his remarks, but that's not the point. For those remarks, he was arrested in November of 2005, sentenced in February to 3 years. 3 years in prison for remarks made 16 years earlier.
Hmm.
He was released in December. An appeals court ruled that he could serve out the rest of the sentence in probation. And of course, he promptly went to England. And he's not even an Austrian citizen.
Right.
Having said this about these laws, I think that fortunately there's been such a tremendous amount of international attention given to these laws and to the sentence against particularly David Irving that there's some embarrassment now in Europe about these laws. I think that the high point of these laws has probably already been reached. when David Irving was sentenced in February last year to 3 years in prison, there was a flood of editorials and opinion pieces mm-hmm. in newspapers from Buenos Aires to Bangkok, from Toronto to Mexico City, and in the United States and in Britain, mm-hmm. severely condemning, severely criticizing the sentencing of Irving and criticizing the laws under which David Irving, Aaron Sundel, and others have been imprisoned and fined and so forth. And this is the largest outpouring of opposition to these laws that we've ever seen. And I think that the ability of groups like the World Jewish Congress and Israel and so forth to get these laws introduced in other countries mm-hmm. has effectively ended. I doubt very much that they would have much success in introducing these laws in additional countries.
Right.
When Irving was sentenced, and again when he was released, the only groups, the only voices in favor of keeping him in prison or putting him in prison were from the Simon Wiesenthal Center, the Anti-Defamation League in New York, two major Zionist organizations, from Israeli officials and so forth. In other words, the only voices in favor of these amazing censorship laws were from just ardent, predictable right. Zionist voices.
Right.
Around the world, there's a wide agreement that these laws are just intellectually and morally indefensible.
Absolutely. They're ridiculous.
They're ridiculous by
Mark,
any objective
uh-huh.
standard or measure.
Mark, we need to go to a break. When we get back, I really want to get into, and how do you pronounce his last name, Sundel?
Sundel.
Sundel,
yeah.
Sundel, okay.
He calls himself that.
Yeah, I'd like to get into his story, what it is that, you know, he said or wrote about that so inflamed people that they lose their mind and put an old man like him in jail. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Okay, I'm back. I'm speaking live with Mark Weber. He is the director at the Institute for Historical Review, IHR.org. And we're just about to pop into Mr. Zundel. It's going to be hard for me to remember how you said it. Zundel. I'm going to have to say Zundel. One of my listeners, though, does want to know, have you gotten any threats for the work you do?
Well, yes. Things are better now, but in 1984, our offices destroyed. They were burned down in an arson attack, which later it came out was carried out by the Jewish Defense League, which is a small extremist terrorist group, the leader of which is now dead, Irv Rubin. He was later arrested for his attempt to blow up a congressman's office and a mosque, and either committed suicide or was killed in prison. Mm. But yeah, the IHR offices were destroyed in an arson attack in 1984. There were a lot of other attacks. You'll find a lot more about that on our website as well. But since then, things have been very quiet. I think the reason for that, the main reason for that, is that in the last 10, 15 years, the number of those who groups like the JDL consider to be enemies has grown so large that we're just one of many targets out there.
Right.
For example, there's a great deal now of dispute and argument and so forth on campuses, college and university campuses across the country by people who are anti-Israel, who are critical of Israel and its policies. And this has now become a kind of front line for many groups.
Mm-hmm.
And the IHR is also, I think the second reason there hasn't been any attacks in recent years is that in spite of the arson attack in 1984, again, that was more than 20 years ago, the IHR has endured and has thrived, and so have many other groups, which organizations like the ADL would like to have disappear, have popped up in addition. I mean, it's remarkable that just in the last few weeks, in fact, or months, a great deal of attention and criticism has been directed at former President Jimmy Carter for his new book,
right.
So much so that even the ADL now calls him an anti-Semite. This is just ridiculous, really, but it truly shows the extent to which there's been a shift, I think, over the last several years.
Well, it's a term that's worked for them for a long time, but they're going to need to get over it.
Now, its power, a great deal of its impact.
Well, you know, I was thinking about, I think it's the Simon Wiesenthal Center that supposedly they're the Nazi hunters. And I sometimes think, because I know so much about our history and all the top Nazis that we took in and seeded the CIA and NASA with, how come they missed them? You know, how is it they didn't go after them?
Right.
Anyway, let's get over to Ernst Story.
Okay.
Because, you know, I've read a lot about him on his website as well, and I will put a live link to that website in today's show as well so people can do your own homework. But he seems like a pretty nice old man, a very talented man, a very calm, peaceful energy, and yet he's in prison and going to trial again this month.
Well, Ernst Sundel was born in Germany in 1938-39. He emigrated when he was, I think, 18 years old to Canada. He lived for a little more than 40 years in Canada. He was a very successful graphic artist. His temperament and his main skill is as an artist, as a graphic artist, and he was very successful in that. But he, in the 70s, he became very offended by the Holocaust television emphasis, and he started a group called Concerned German Canadian Parents, something like this. And he published or reprinted a booklet called "Did 6 Million Really Die," which was a skeptical look at the Holocaust story. Jewish organizations brought a lawsuit against him, and there were two very spectacular trials in Canada against Ernst Sundel for having reprinted this booklet. One was in 1985 and one was in 1988. I was a witness in the 1988 trial for 5 days, in fact.
Uh-huh.
At the end of these trials, well, the first trial was declared a mistrial because an appeals court ruled that the judge had acted improperly. Sundel was found guilty by the jury in the second trial. Then the case worked its way up to the Canadian Supreme Court, and the Canadian Supreme Court finally decided that the law under which Ernst Sundel had been prosecuted was unconstitutional and threw it out, so that Ernst Sundel had actually secured greater rights for Canadians, and for that reason, I think is owed a debt of gratitude by Canadians for having protected, actually, or defended and increased their rights under Canadian law. But that didn't stop the organizations that wanted to silence him. The Canadian Jewish Congress, the Canadian branch of the Anti-Defamation League in the United States, the Canadian branch of the Simon Wiesenthal Center, promptly launched a new campaign to try to put him behind bars on the basis of the website that is actually run by his wife in the United States. And he then moved to the United States, was living quietly in Tennessee with his wife, who's a naturalized U.S. citizen, and then was, 3 years ago, was seized at his home by immigration officials, deported to Canada, held in Canada for more than a year in solitary confinement under very humiliating and harsh conditions, then was deported to Germany, and now he's on trial in Germany under Germany's bizarre so-called Holocaust denial laws. So he's been held now for more than 3 years in prison without having been convicted of any crime. He's not been found guilty of anything under any law, but he's been bounced around and treated very harshly in these prisons in Canada and in Germany, and now faces the prospect of a sentence of years in prison for violating that country's so-called Holocaust denial laws. And that's the situation right now. The trial is still ongoing, and there's the dates of an expected verdict in the case have been changed, but realistically, there'll probably be a verdict early in this new year.
Right. Why is it, do you think? Do you think Germany somehow is trying to apologize to the world by having this draconian law for, you know, being the thought police?
Well, the laws that exist in Germany, Austria, France, Switzerland, and a few other European countries that criminalize dissident views on the Holocaust are a result of a concerted campaign by the World Jewish Congress and by Israel to impose these laws in as many countries as possible. And you'll find more information about that as well on our website. Mm-hmm. But Germany has, since World War II, made tremendous efforts to, as they put it, to atone for the past, to pay tremendous billions and billions of dollars in reparations to Israel and to Jewish organizations in an effort to, make itself a kind of, as much as possible, acceptable, normal, you might say, in the world. And
right.
Germany has, in fact, it gives a special, even privileged status for not only Jews in Europe, but Germany also has given a tremendous amount of economic and financial aid to Israel over the years. Now, this policy, just like the policy of the United States about the Iraq War, is not supported by many Germans, by most Germans. Most Germans think that this has gone way, way beyond any kind of reasonable time frame and should be ended, but on it goes. I mean,
right.
just recently, Germany turned over to Israel two nuclear-powered submarines, which reportedly are being outfitted with nuclear missiles. Very dangerous. But anyway, this is part of Germany's overall effort over the years to, as they put it, atone for the past and to try to be accepted by, especially the United States and by Israel.
Right. Well, you know, since from my understanding, as the first people they rounded up were liberals, then gays, then Jehovah's Witnesses, before they came for the Jews, what are they going to do to make up for that?
Well,
you know what I'm saying? I mean, you look at it, it's ridiculous.
Well, and there is a tremendous double standard about this. Germany is paying and has been paying immense amounts of money as restitution or as reparations for property lost by Jews, but property lost by other people is just not, there's just no restitution for
them. Well, that's the point.
Millions of Germans, ethnic Germans, lost their property and their lives.
Right.
What is now Poland and Czechoslovakia at the end of the war. And of course, many Poles also. But they don't get anything like the treatment, the privileged treatment or the special treatment.
No, but wouldn't it be nice if they could pass, you know, laws to protect liberals and gays the same way? I'd be all for that. You know what I'm saying?
I think it's a very...
It's common sense to me. You look at this is ridiculous, and you say, how does this happen? You know, how do these countries manage to pass these kind of laws and hold a man like Zindel as a threat to national security? I mean, that's bizarre.
Right. Well, the holding of on the basis of a threat to national security was in Canada. That seizure, that incarceration was condemned even by some of the most prominent newspapers in Canada. There were any number of voices saying that really this is just absurd and ridiculous. But they did it anyway. It's also very clear the only voices publicly that were demanding the incarceration of Ernst Zindel were from the predictable groups like the Simon Wiesenthal Center and the Anti-Defamation League and so forth.
Mm.
Ernst Zindel, by no stretch of the imagination, is any kind of threat to Canada or to any other country. He's a peaceful man. He's a pacifist. His so-called crime consists entirely in peaceful expressions of his views.
Mm.
Now, whether he's right or wrong, that's really irrelevant. People have a right to be wrong, and people certainly have a right to, especially in a society that allows people to say very startling things about, well, 9/11 or about all sorts of issues, to incarcerate someone for dissident views just on this one chapter of history.
Right.
Not only unjust, it's blatantly hypocritical. It's a blatant double standard.
Well, we were all warned in this country that you should not even speak out after 9/11, you know, not to say a thing about, you know, against our government, against Bush, or, you know, or even try to bring the truth out on 9/11. So, you know, when people make comparisons to America now and pre, you know, Nazi Germany, you know, they seem to be right on target.
Well, you know, having said that, Maria, I mean, we're able to be on this program
so
here,
far.
And there's a great deal of open voices of dissent in this country about all of this. You know, not long after the Iraq War, President Bush condemned and castigated those people who were skeptical of his claims about weapons of mass destruction. He called them revisionists. He says, those are revisionist historians. Well, in fact, they were right. Revisionism is simply being skeptical of official orthodox history or orthodox views about anything. And no healthy society can survive. Every healthy society requires people with a skeptical or a healthy skepticism about what the government and the people in authority tell them. And the most obvious lesson about that has to do with the Iraq War, when our president and vice president and leaders told us over and over and over that we could not wait even a few weeks to attack Iraq because it posed such a serious threat to the United States and the world because it had these mythical large arsenals of weapons of mass destruction.
Right, they couldn't wait to hang Hussein either.
The world knows it's untrue.
Uh-huh.
That's actually very encouraging to me because we now know, the world knows the facts about this in a way that's pretty remarkable, because oftentimes in the past it's taken many more years than this for the truth about events to really emerge. It took a longer time for the background to the Vietnam War to come out than it did for the background, really, of the Iraq War.
Right, and we still have to wait till 2032 to see the papers on the assassination of John Kennedy.
Well, and I'm very encouraged that in spite of all the efforts to try to control things, Internet, above all, has changed the entire equation. There's now a greater openness, a greater access to information than ever before in history.
Absolutely.
It's certainly very, very different than the situation back in the 1960s and during the Vietnam War, when there were essentially three big television networks. That's where you got your television news.
Mm.
And just a handful of newspapers that had real impact and influence in our society. I mean, there was a much greater concentration of news than there is today.
Mm.
Because now people can very rapidly, instantly, get news from all around the world. And we have access, for example, all the time from newspapers in other countries that give a very different perspective.
Uh-huh.
Current events and historical events in a way that didn't used to be true.
Right, exactly. But, you know, I agree. And, you know, I'm sure you haven't been interviewed in quite this fashion on any public television station any time recent.
Well, two weeks ago, I was on the Hannity and Combs Fox News television show.
Uh-huh.
I've never been, in all the years I've been interviewed, ever treated as rudely, as disrespectfully, and just terribly as I was on that show. These characters are not even pretending to be objective. They just are. I mean, they used me as a verbal punching bag. But no, that's right. I wasn't treated at all respectfully on that.
Right, and you know, you have to look at that and say, you know, what is it that, you know, they want to immediately deride people like you? You know, get so many people that are what I consider heroes on these ridiculous TV shows, which is why I tossed my television 2 years ago.
Well,
and just rip you to pieces.
Everyone who studies this knows there's been an increasing kind of sensationalizing of news and information in our society. Not only our television, but our political leaders more and more resort to just slogans, short sound bites. Our education is not as the level of our education has decreased. The level of our public discourse has fallen, and that's very dangerous. We have a less educated, a less aware public, and there's a greater level of just cynicism, I think, in our society, understandably so, about our government, about our society, and all of this is very, very toxic, very dangerous for the long-term health of our society and for the world, because our country is the most important one, above all, militarily in the world.
Right. Now, I understand Mr. Zindel's trial is resuming on January 12th.
Right, or 10th or 12th, right. Yes, and people have been expecting a resolution of the trial before now, but it's dragged on longer. In the last several months, it's dragged out in a lot of motions and counter motions and debate about procedural matters and evidentiary matters and so forth. But it's pretty clear, I think, and pretty reasonable to expect that he's going to be handed a very stiff sentence, because if the German government does not jail Ernst Zindel, it might as well just throw out the law, because Ernst Zindel is most identified as a Holocaust dissident, and he's a German citizen too. So if they don't hammer him, it's hard to see why they should even have these laws.
Right.
The laws are more and more embarrassing, I think, in Germany. They're more and more embarrassing all over Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And as I, for the reasons I mentioned earlier,
Well, they're embarrassing everywhere.
They're embarrassing. Well,
we should all have freedom of thought and freedom of expression, whether people agree with us or not. And there shouldn't be just one specific elite group that is all of a sudden hands off when we all have eyes in our heads to see what's going on in Palestine today.
Right.
So, you know, that's, you know, the way I look at it. You know, I read some of that. Let me see if I can remember what you said the title of it was 6 million.
And really die.
Right. And I read some of it, and I don't know when that was written, but I could tell you it was pretty darn interesting. And again, I think
it was written in the 1970s, and a great deal of information has emerged since that booklet was first published and first appeared that strengthens and modifies much of what's in the book. But again, I would refer to people who want to know more about that whole aspect of things to go directly to our website. Go especially on the leaflet section of our website, and you'll find these fairly readable summaries of the evidence and of the information and the state of the debate on these issues.
Right, and one of my listeners has a question. He says, why hasn't the disastrous testimony against him not exonerated him yet? Do you think they have no intention of exonerating him?
Because this is a very crucial point. Under German law, and even in Canada, truth is no defense. The court has ruled that even if what Ernst Sundel says is true, it's no defense. The law is written in such a way, and was also in Canada in such a way, that it didn't matter if the statements were true. It mattered only if they were regarded as offensive to Jews, or in this case, to Jews. That's the crucial thing. That's an astonishing thing.
Right.
I mean, there was a case several years ago regarding David Irving in Munich, in which he said publicly that the gas chamber that's shown to the public in Auschwitz I main camp is a phony post-war reconstruction. And he was called into court, and he tried to call as a witness for himself the curator of the Auschwitz State Museum in Poland to confirm that what he said was true. The court rejected the motion on the grounds that it doesn't matter. In fact, the statement that Irving made was true, but that didn't stop the court from imposing a very heavy fine on Irving for making this statement and of banning him from the country as a result of it. But that's the reason why the situation is so bad.
Right. And, you know, I'm sure people listening would say, you know, why should we care? And, you know, of course, the words of Martin Luther King come into my head. You know, freedom can't exist for any of us unless freedom exists for all of us.
Well, yeah, I mean, people should care because this has consequences for all of us, both directly and indirectly. Directly because of the danger of suppression of free speech in our country and in other countries, but also indirectly because of the way in which this particular chapter of history is given this status and given this place in our society, the consequences of which we're supposed to automatically have a sympathy for Israel and its policies that would otherwise be indefensible.
Right, try to justify, you know, them being the new Nazis.
Policies that we support with our tax money, soldiers, and with our the lives of our young men that would otherwise be indefensible.
Exactly. Mark, I have to tell you, you have quite the world of information there, and of course I want you to keep me posted on what happens at this trial.
Well, we'll do that right away on our website. There's a great deal on the homepage of our website of current affairs, too, that relate to the larger world historical situation. And of course, we immediately post anything that's of really news and topical, newsy and topical, when it relates especially to Ernst Sundel or David Irving or these kinds of things as well.
Right. Well, thank you so much, and thanks for all the work there. And again, you know, listeners, get over to IHR.org and check it out, especially. Do you have your film on there already, the one you sent me last night?
Our video presentation, it's on the upper right. You just click on there, and you can see that as well. But thank you very much, Maria, for having me as a guest on your show.
Okay. It's been my pleasure, Mark.
Okay.
Take good care. Okay, there you go. Let's face it, if they lie to us about everything now, they lie to us about everything forever. So it's just, you know, it's just one more red pill show. What can I say? Okay, tonight we have our meetup group online. Join in with your Yahoo Instant Message. We'll come in and find you. It's at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll talk about whatever it is we feel like talking about. Some of you are saying today was a great show. It's a great website. You know what? It's an education. And I am so sick and tired of finding out that everything that I thought was my reality was bull crap, and I'm sure you might be feeling the same. Doing the homework is just a fascinating thing. Anyway, tomorrow, you've heard me talk about his work before. Matthew Deluse from England will be on the show. We're going to be talking about his book, The Stars Are Falling. And I know it's for sale on David Icke's website. And he really gets into a lot of things that have happened to him and a lot into the reptilian agenda. There's a topic. So I think you'll all pretty much enjoy it. And one of my listeners, Mark G, sent me this song, and he said, could you please close tomorrow's show with it? And I said, absolutely. It's a song by George Harrison, and it's called Beware of Darkness. And I think that it's quite appropriate to close with today's show. So I'll see you guys tomorrow. Thanks for supporting the show.